Hey, it's David Cáceres. And coming up on Counter Stories, what's true and what isn't true about parenting in minority communities. We're going to explore the myth of the absent black father, a convenient scapegoat for pundits and politicians. But even if a father isn't in the home, that doesn't mean our children don't have father figures.
My experience growing up, your father might not have necessarily been your biological father. I had grandfathers, I had uncles, I had all these folks who were playing that particular role, and at some case, my mom had to step in that regard.
And what about other minority families? Sometimes fathers aren't around because they're trying to do the right thing.
My dad worked second shift, and so by the time we woke up, he was still sleeping for school. Mm-hmm. By the time we got home from school, he had already gone to work. And then he'd come home at 2 in the morning. So we would all lay on the couch and fall asleep. So dad came home and he'd have to carry us all to bed. And that was like our interaction with my dad growing up.
And, as always on Counter Stories, something to think about.
You've got a 50% divorce rate in the nation. Mm-hmm. And those families are not complete. But those isms and those stereotypes are not transferred over to them. It's only if you are low income or from a community of color, historically marginalized, that these stereotypes then come into play.
This is my favorite time of the week. I'm David Cáceres, the host of Counter Stories, here with the Counter Stories team.
Anthony Galloway, race equity advocate in the West Metro.
Luz Maria Frias, an attorney with a public policy background.
Lee Lee, digital media artist.
Don Eubanks, cultural consultant and assistant professor.
Anthony Galloway, you know, I was looking at some pictures on your Facebook page the other day, and I was really inspired and happy to see you with your daughter at a father-daughter dance, because one of the best parts of my life is my relationship with my two daughters, and it's been something that has inspired me and motivated me to keep moving on. And it also causes me to think a lot about life and how I want their lives to be. So I've got a lot of things on my mind this week, and I know you do. So I'm going to toss it right to you.
Yeah, you know, it was a great experience. This is actually the second year. My brother-in-law put me on game about it last year. And we went and had such a great time. When I went this year, though, it was amazing. There was like 520 fathers, most of them who were black, and their daughters just dancing. The most memorable part is when all the fathers hit the dance floor after the dinner. The first funny part is they always serve something that's easy to spill on dresses. So you got all these fathers like on super ultra watch trying to keep their daughters spinning from spilling on these dresses.
Who has the Tide stick?
Right.
What was it, spaghetti?
Oh, it was spaghetti this year. Oh, I was so nervous. Like, I basically tied her up.
Not
and
even
fed
near
her.
Yeah.
Right? But we get to the dance floor and you know, last year, Katy Perry's Roar came out, and there was a picture of all the fathers who didn't know the song yet, and all the girls were in the middle jumping and dancing and having this time, and all the fathers just dancing and loving it with me. And it just dawned on me that a majority of my peer group who I know are fathers who are very involved, not necessarily with their mother in the situation, but are very involved parents.
Wait a minute. You mean fathers are involved parents?
Exactly. 550 fathers and their daughters, and a lot of it made me think about a lot of the statistics that you see. Mm-hmm. Will compare father absenteeism to rates of single parent households, which don't necessarily gel, because I grew up in a single parent household. I still very much knew my father.
Yeah, when you first brought up this topic, I was thinking of the Larry Wilmore episode where it was all about black fathers. Mm-hmm. And they went out on the street and they asked a bunch of black guys, like, what do you think the rate is of kids being born into single parent households, black kids? And everybody was saying, oh, 85, oh, 30, and he comes on, he says the statistic is 72. So Anthony, when you brought this topic up, I was like, oh, well, you know, the statistic is 72%. Mm-hmm. Right, that people, black kids are born into single parent households. And you said to me,
it doesn't connect at the same time with rates of participation from not just fathers, but in my experience growing up, your father might not have necessarily been your biological father. And this is something that goes back into black experience all the way back to our laws around welfare and before, all the way back to the plantation. But I had grandfathers, I had uncles, I had all these folks who were playing that particular role. And at some case, my mom had to step in that regard. So in terms of what you consider a father presence or not, is very different than the rates of single parents.
But also, it wasn't something, when they give you that number, you just think, oh, these poor kids are born to mothers only who don't have fathers present. But just because they're born into a single parent household doesn't mean the dad's not involved somehow.
Exactly. And if you could have seen the interactions between these fathers and their daughters, you know, actually, Don, when we went out to the Ethiopian restaurant and your daughter came with us.
Oh, yeah.
The interactions between you two, and I'm sitting there taking notes, right? When I stopped and I looked back, all of the fathers who I can think of taking notes from about what I loved about their interactions with their daughters, they were all people of color.
Oh, really?
So I haven't lived an experience that gels with all the statistics and the doomsayers out there, including within the black community.
And black fathers, like a lot of fathers, aren't monolithic.
Exactly.
I mean, there are a lot of married black fathers.
Exactly.
I know a lot of them. And I consider myself one.
There are three of them in this room
as
today.
You are, and it's Mr. Galloway. I mean, Mr. Eubanks, I'm sorry. But despite the presence of married black fathers, even if a father is not in the home, that doesn't mean he's not involved in his children's lives.
And the important piece is, as soon as you start to mention a father who's absentee, you know, NPR did a really good thing on implicit bias in the police today and all those kinds of things and raising those things up. And Luz, you've talked about that quite a bit as well. There's a picture that goes in your mind when you start to think of an absent father. And a lot of times it ends up being folks who are looked at as low socioeconomics. They're looked at as folks who don't have as much education. There's an archetype that starts to be built. Now, I grew up in a single parent household. I grew up in a family that had experienced not just poverty, but homelessness. Like, I was in that experience. But I can always think back to a positive male figure who would fit every single stereotypical look that pops into people's minds when you talk about the presence of the father. And yet I have all these men who have instilled in me all these great things over time, some of whom who had jobs, some of whom who didn't, some of whom might have been in some nefarious stuff, and some of them who weren't.
You know, the other interesting dynamic to this conversation is you have a stereotype, as you said, the archetype that's painted in your mind as a listener or someone who's watching the TV when you see a single parent household. Generally speaking, if it's black or Latino. But if you think about it, you've got a 50% divorce rate in the nation. Mm-hmm. And those families are not complete, right? You're typically speaking, one parent has custody of the children. But those isms and those stereotypes are not transferred over to them. It's only if you are somehow low income or from a family of color, community of color, historically marginalized, that these stereotypes then come into play.
So is it more of a thing that's like, oh, you're not man enough to be a father, or is it like the woman is just not able to keep a man?
Well, and this is the thing. There's a particular, you know, way of being a father that folks, and particularly in dominant society, look at, right? So if I'm not only buying clothes for you, if we go hang out on a regular basis, if I'm showing up in difficult conversations, all of those things are markers of fatherhood and interactions. But if I'm not there every other weekend or every single day, does that make that interaction less quality than the person who suffers a bogus relationship just to stay in the house?
See, now you're touching on some, I think, social dynamics, because there can be fathers who are physically there, but emotionally aren't involved.
They're disconnected.
Exactly. And so, so when we talk about that or when we raise this whole specter, because the largest category of low-income folks in the United States are single mothers, but they're not all black.
Mm-mm.
The majority of them aren't black. But in our conversation in this country, it only centers on low-income black and black single mothers and the fact that they must have absent fathers.
Right.
Go ahead.
I want to bring that back, Don, to what we're talking about here at Counterstars. This is not just a black issue.
No.
This is not just a, you know, black and brown issue, right? This happens to our communities as well. And it's not talked about as much, but it does happen to the Asian community. It does happen to the Native community. And it happens to every community. It happens to the white community. You know, as an immigrant community, my dad wasn't around a lot. I mean, he was physically there. My parents are married. But he worked second shift. It was the only shift that he could work. We never saw him during the week.
There was a beautiful moment where we're sitting at the table and this Hmong man comes in. And he sits down. And the only reason I knew he was Hmong is because I could recognize that he was speaking Hmong. And so he sits down with his daughter and her two friends who were Somali, and their father worked nights and couldn't be there for the dance. So he took his whole daughter's peer group step in and be that father. Like, these are the experiences and stories that seem much more common than what you start to see in these particular articles.
And the importance of really highlighting this is that this is not a one-off. I mean, this has been happening for years and years, right?
Good point.
This is not something new, so you should talk more about that.
Yeah, David, you sent me an article that showed a Chicago organization doing a father-daughter dance.
Right.
And it led me to start to look, and apparently, not only are these father-daughter dances common, you know, mad props to Terry Austin, who runs the Positive Images organization here, which looks at father-father interaction, but this is something that happens not only in cities across America, but this particular event actually has history, goes back. When I brought this to my uncles and other family members, they would talk about father-daughter experiences or outings or picnics or things like that. Not picnics. I'm going to strike that from my vocabulary.
I was about to correct you on that one. Cookouts.
Cookouts and stuff like that. We'll go into the history of that later. But they had experienced things like this, and it was an important piece in rites of passage in terms of relationships. So it alluded in my mind to that this isn't a new experience, even within my community.
That's right. Hey, I hate to be a downer, somebody would say, but there's a lot of people out there, even some very prominent people, who blame the absence of fathers for a lot of things. They'll say, well, children aren't in school, or they're not getting enough to eat, or they're out on the street. And it's all because there's no father in the home. Even the president has said, well, we need to have more fathers in the home. And maybe we do. But that's not the cure-all for everything. Even if you assigned a black father or made sure that minority fathers and every father, white fathers, every father was in the home, I mean, that doesn't mean, you know, that the cancer is going to be cured or that all of a sudden everybody in the country is going to go to college. But yet, that seems to be the solution that a lot of prominent people in a lot of our communities do.
It also undermines the value of women who have been able to fill both roles.
Boom.
I mean, I've got, you know, a sister who was divorced early on, and she has, like many other women in our circles, done a phenomenal job and stepped in both roles. Both of her girls, you know, outstanding academic students and just contributors to the society. But that narrative is just wrong. And I think too often society looks for that quick fix and that quick solution to blame something rather than being more analytical and asking what parts of this are working and what parts aren't working and where do we go from there?
And when it lets our institutions off the hook, doesn't it?
Well, David, when we talk about these things that people are saying, are we talking about boys saying, oh, the boys are on the street because there's no dad in the home? And then, you know, a lot of times they'll say, oh, the girl has daddy issues, right? So, I mean, when we're saying people are blaming absentee dads for low rates of graduation, I mean, are we talking boys or girls? There's a very big difference.
And it's that's the correlative effect that our institutional racism can put on us. So if poverty and that stress of being in those particular environments stress everything about the relationship in the household, right? And we have people of color who are overrepresented in those situations, you're going to have effects all the way around the board. What I challenge is the notion that those fathers who may not be in relationship are absent. And our assumption along that has bled into our court system in terms of how we deal with separations or custody. It has bled into child support issues. It has even bled into, you know, if I don't fit this mold of a father, then all I'm going to hear by even being halfway involved is how bad of a father I am. My father experienced that. He would come out and he would try to do what he could to try to put something together. And then somebody would zero in on him and talk about how bad of a father is. And then he would disappear for a while because somebody else in my family came and said, you suck as a father. And now I don't get it. What I was starting to get is gone because he didn't fit this particular mold.
I think there's also, and especially in Minnesota, in the court system, that, you know, if parents are separated or they're getting divorced or they weren't married in the first place to a child, the preference always goes to the mother. And that's not always the case that the mother is the right parent. But I think I think in our society, the preference always goes to the mother.
Well, it's really what's in the best interest of the child, having done this work in the past. And there is...
Oh, really? That's your belief then, huh?
No, that's how the law is written.
That's how the law is written.
Right. I was starting to clarify that before I was interrupted. The law is written in the best interest of the child. So it ends up having more dynamics into it, and there's about, if I remember correctly, like 16 factors. But the point being that I wanted to get to, though, is that too often, it was my experience having practiced for 8 years and then another 6 years on the bench, that parents focus more on the parental dynamics, meaning the finances of it and their relationships with each other, and unfortunately use the children as pawns, and it wasn't in the best interest of the child. It wasn't, you know, can we figure out a parenting schedule that will work for the two households that are physically not connected? And there were some parents who had taken the time and who were able to interact at that level, but far and wide, that wasn't the case. So it ends up being very acrimonious and too often driven by money, which is not good, and it's not in the best interest.
One thing that happens, I think, in a lot of immigrant communities is our marriages are not always recognized in the U.S. Mm-hmm. And so when parents separate or divorce, there's no legal world saying you owe child support, you owe, you know, you do this, you do that, we don't even file for divorce, you know. And so I remember growing up, if I had an aunt or an uncle who were divorced, it was like, oh my gosh, she's the one that's divorced. It was like the horrible things that would happen, and it was almost always blamed on the woman. Mm-hmm. That she could not keep her man in the house.
And it's interesting that we go flip that all the way around. A lot of the blame is placed on particularly males in my community for the breakup, and then subsequently are pushed out in our same legal proceedings. I have many, many friends who are perfectly committed fathers, right, who then go through that separation process, and they're pushed out of the household and charged with child support because that seems like a better setup than some other kind of joint custody arrangement, which would benefit the kid, but are not, because we have this stigma about what a father should look
like. But this doesn't go to say that fathers do disappear. Right. I mean, it does happen. So we're not saying like every divorced parent or whatever is they're all trying their best, because sometimes they're not. So I just don't want people listening to be like, oh, they're defending every single parent in the world.
Well, we also don't want people to think that we don't know that many fathers are present.
Right.
By the way, how many of us had fathers at home?
I certainly did. And he made sure we were on the front row of the church every Sunday.
We did, too. But we weren't the big church callers. I mean, just I want to be real on this one, but heavy presence in the home, and certainly one that included the entire family. So our family, of course, in Latino, it's not the nuclear family. We go into the grandparents and cousins.
Thank you. I was about to say, I have four. You know, I had my dad who would pop in and out depending on what was happening. But then I had all these other men. I had uncles. I had my future father-in-law who pulled me out of being on my own in 11th grade, living on my own, paying my own bills at 11th grade. So, I mean, that perspective of what constitutes the father has to be very different. Because when you do that, then you open the door for more involvement.
But there's nothing wrong with fathers who want to play
exactly
that role of being more of a traditional father.
Exactly.
And I had a very traditional father. Once I was at a meeting, I was at a dinner, and I wanted to leave to get home to my wife and daughters, who were much younger at the time. And a guy, a Latino guy, said, "Well, what kind of Latino father are you?" You know, I said, "I'm the kind of Latino father who's going home to his kids." You know, that's the kind of Latino father I am. And I had that kind of father who was always there. And I don't want to discount the presence of men like that. And he was a role model for me. He wasn't perfect, and neither am I. But there's many different ways to be a father, and I try to do the best way I can, just as my dad did it the best way he could.
My dad was always the one that, like, my mom would say, "Wait until your dad gets home," because you know, my dad worked second shift, and so by the time we woke up, he was still sleeping for school. Mm-hmm. By the time we got home from school, he had already gone to work. and then he'd come home at 2 a.m. So we would all lay on the couch and fall asleep. So dad came home and he'd have to carry us all to bed. And that was like our interaction with my dad growing up. Mm-hmm. And we'd only see him on the weekends. And so then mom, you know, he calls home once every day around the same time. And we'd all get on the phone and say, "Dad, this is what we did today, blah, 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 blah." And that was our relationship with our dad, but we always respected him, and he was always the one that would discipline us. But also at the same time, he was like the fun one, because like he didn't see us very often, and so when he did see us, he was always really fun. So I think that a lot of immigrant communities probably face that, because my parents were very concerned with just making enough money to feed us, that dad would take on various jobs, and mom mm-hmm. would do work, you know, jobs to work from home, making, assembling different things out of boxes and for 10 cents a piece, you know, and so that was our life.
And just from it ticks my educator's mind coming at it, because working in the education system, you'll hear a lot of the explanations for this gap issue being parent involvement in big air quotes, right?
You're saying gap in terms of the opportunity education gap.
Exactly. So one of the reasonings that some excuses that some folks will give is that parents aren't in the home. So if your mom only showed up to school events and your dad didn't show up to school events, you know, it would tick off somebody like, well, you know, maybe the reason you might not be doing so well is that there's not as much parent involvement versus the stay-at-home parent who can
right.
show up for every
but
single
But I always
event.
Thought it was ridiculous when we'd have, like, pancake breakfast.
Exactly.
You know, like, on a Tuesday, and I'm like, well, my dad's at work and my mom has two other kids. She's not going to be able to come. And then I always felt like I was an outcast when other people's parents came. So I was like, oh, I don't have a parent that could come with me, you know?
But that highlights also the dominant structure that's systemic in our institutions, from the standpoint that it doesn't allot for the other variables of
exactly.
how else our society is functioning, right? How our working parents are functioning, which is what you are alluding to, Haley, and the cultural aspects that need to come in to be able to really understand that it's not a one-size-fits-all that's been defined 50 years ago and never shall it change or be amended.
I had a parent come in, and she was very upset because a teacher had tried to school her on what her involvement should be with her child. And so she was trying to call somebody because she was hot. And she, hot being mad, not necessarily that statement of beauty, just to clarify. So she comes in, she's upset, and I'm talking to her about it, and she said the parents said the teacher said she needed to be more involved because her child wasn't doing well. And she's like, look, I get off of work, get home, make sure they do their homework, make sure their homework turns in. They are fed, they are clothed, they love themselves, they love everything about themselves. I'm doing my part. And she's like, what part are you doing at the school system? Because I am more involved than the person over here who's got babysitters and nannies and all those types of things. So talk to them about their involvement. Don't talk to me about my involvement.
Do you think that we have these issues these days now, though? I mean, I think people talk more about helicopter parents than parents not being involved enough.
It depends on
what's a helicopter parent.
Well, helicopter parent is a parent who comes there to solve everything
yeah.
and gets in the way.
Who doesn't get out of the way.
Who doesn't get out of the way. And yeah. I don't know about you, Don, but I never had, my parents were never that way. They said, we're doing the best we can to make sure you're in a position to do the right thing. Mm-hmm. And we expect you to.
Exactly.
Yeah, and I think that, you know, I was just thinking back about my childhood and my parents and the struggle, because it was, you know, for my dad was part of that greatest generation, survivor of World War II. But the thing that just keeps coming to my mind is when I look at my birth certificate and it lists my father and it lists my mother, and I look at my father's occupation at that time, and it's he worked at the Fauché Tower. Remember the Fauché Tower?
Mm-hmm.
And
his it is still there.
His occupation. You can't see it anymore because that used to be the landmark.
Yeah, that's true.
But his occupation was busboy. And that is significant,
mm-hmm.
you know, when you think of the time period, African-American, World War II vet, mm-hmm. and the best he could get was busboy.
Why did they put occupation on your birth certificate?
Well, that they did back then.
It mattered back then. Yeah.
Really?
Yeah. One of my coworkers grew up in Mississippi, and on his birth certificate, it still says Negro, which is very interesting. But to your point, that occupational piece, you know, if we're going to talk about all these gaps, I mean, there's a gap between our assumptions around fathers. There's gaps in all these different areas, particularly for people of color in Minnesota. But that piece right there, a parent who is working and doing all these things to support that particular household, the moment you start to say anything or paint any narrative about whether or not they're involved in participating, you're already starting to set up this hate relationship between you and the families you're coming
in. So, Don, how involved was your father in your life?
He, you know, he worked a lot. He was there. He was involved with our lives up until, you know, unfortunately, him and my mother separated, but I was in college by that time. So my dad was very involved in terms of working, keeping a, you know, trying to do what he could at the best that he could. He had like a, I think he made it through ninth grade before he went into World War II. So it was, I think what was interesting, it was the combination of these two cultures, because my father's African American and my mother's Native American. And so it was the blending of these two cultures and being a part of that and watching the dynamic between my mother and my father. I mean, when I look back on it now, you know, he was doing the best that he could. Because I remember the jobs, you know, some of the jobs, because at one point in time, he actually got a job with the city of Minneapolis, but his job was to go down in the sewer to kill the rats. And that used to traumatize him, you know, and he would come home and share that with us. So so I think, he was very instrumental in our life in providing guidance, you know, teaching me what it was like to be a young dude in the hood and give me the necessary skills I needed to survive that environment.
Those skills are important. Oh, my dad showed me how to hustle a whole bunch of things. I remember one time he came in and I was in college and I was broke and staying at my godmom's basement and stuff like that. He would do little things like he came and he showed me how to play this game at Burger King where you had to drop the little dime on there. He had me get a bunch of change and he just sat there and talked to me while we played this little game in there, right? I got so good that anytime I didn't have food, all I needed to get was a dime and a nickel and go and play this little game and I can get a Junior Whopper and some fries.
Well, you know, I'm sure there's people that might be able to relate to this. My dad was, I remember being bullied in grade school, probably third, fourth grade. And I was also the oldest, you know, and depending on where you're born, there's a pecking order and responsibility and all that kind of stuff that comes along with it. So being the oldest, it was kind of expected of me to kind of take care of my younger brothers and sisters. So when I got bullied, the only person I had to go to was my father. So I went to my dad and I was explaining the situation to him. And here was his response. He said, stand up to this young man, give him your best shot, and if he just shrugs it off, bring a lunch, because you're going to be there all day.
I mean, there's great stories. My uncle, he worked for Ford Motor Company, and we had this huge field. So my grandfather was able to pass, and was one of the first people of color to buy land in Maplewood. And
pass is not being black.
Pass, so you couldn't tell that he was necessarily black. So
I'm glad Luz is here to interpret and break this stuff down for us.
I serve one really important purpose on this podcast.
I spend my entire day raising the racial consciousness of other folks. If you don't know what passing is, go read a book.
I don't really think it means not being black. I think it means
not being called out. Sometimes it means not being noticed.
Too.
Not collecting $200 when you
pass go. Shut up, Don. But my uncle was funny. Every time I go there, he would make sure I knew some how to fix the lawnmower because there was a whole lot of field to cut. And I got so mad at him because he was always like, oh, you just want to show me this so I would have to cut this field. No, summer came around and folks got really tired of cutting their own lawns. I was your guy. Not only could I fix the lawnmower, but I could mow the whole lawn. I made bank. So you have these folks who drop in and just give these little cool skills to you that people take for granted.
Mm. Speaking of passing, you know, sometimes people that we encounter every day would like not to notice our race and culture. And I sometimes wonder whether that's a problem when you look at the statistics that are bad, because they prefer not to notice and prefer not to have any responsibility for your future when they ought to have it. Instead, they'll say, it's the father or it's the parents, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe that was an unnecessary segue, but I thought, it just popped into my head, I'd say it.
It's one of those well-meaning white people kind of things to say, I don't see color.
I don't see race.
I don't see race. I don't see color. You know, but my bedroom is Oriental style, or I love Oriental art. You know, it's one of those things where growing up, people, you know, I went to an elementary school. People would ask me like, oh, what about in the Asian culture? What's the word for this? So what's, you know, what do you guys do about this? And I always remember thinking, this is really weird. Like, I feel really awkward that you've like singled me out in front of the whole class. And that was when I was like in third grade.
Well, you know, I don't think much has changed for some sectors in our community. This week in particular, I had an opportunity to mentor a couple of young Latino students who are contemplating going to law school. Mm. They're finishing their undergrad, and I took them to a big event, you know, where it was hosted by the Hispanic Bar Association here in Minnesota. So we had over 200 people there in attendance. And the comment that I kept hearing from students in terms of me asking them, where are you going to go to law school? Or if they were law students ready to graduate and go into the field to practice, it didn't matter if you were an undergrad or if you were coming out of high school. What I kept hearing was, I don't want to be in Minnesota. Mm-hmm. And I asked them, why is that? And they said they are tired of being the onlys. They're tired of being...
Or the few
in the study that they're at, you know, and some of them go to the U of M. So large schools, and in terms of undergrad and the law school, and it's exhausting. And on my way over here, I was on the phone, my car phone, so it was safe, talking to a colleague. And she's
a car phone.
And I just imagine something from like the Bond movies.
it's integrated. You know what I'm talking about.
Oh, got Bluetooth.
But
right,
Bluetooth.
Cool.
So, and she's an African American woman, a good friend of mine, and successful. She's an attorney, and being asked to be in various leadership roles. And she was talking to me about how tired she is of being the only. So I'm receiving that information not only from the young people who I'm trying to mentor, but older colleagues who are in the field. And it's very exhausting to go through your life as one of the few, and being seen as someone who is supposed to be successful.
Or but, you should be satisfied.
No, you should be satisfied. But getting the dominant culture treating you as if you're the only, because you're not, and you know that you're not, but because of the demographics of our society here in Minnesota, we often find ourselves in that situation.
But sometimes we are the only in a company. I think, you know, one thing that I wish people would have told me, you know, I went to Highland Park Senior High School, and I was in the IB courses, and I was the only person of color in most of my classes. And I just thought, oh, this is going to change when I become a professional, right? It doesn't. Someone, no. You know, it's like you need to learn that that's not going to change. The first office job that I got, people were like, oh, that's great that you're here. Do you want to join the diversity committee? You know, I mean, and it doesn't stop at school.
But broaching that conversation makes you go, because our numbers say, you know, in that article, that recent article about, you know, great Minneapolis or miracle Minneapolis points that out. There are some folks who are like, if I look at Minnesota in the aggregate, I can feel really good about where I am. But if I have to talk about issues pertaining to people of color, I'm gonna feel bad about where I live. And so I just want to carve that conversation out so I can just go back to feeling good.
And that's why the Twin Cities is we're so good at recruiting professionals of color here. We just can't keep them. We can't keep them.
Mm. And that's also important in education, where we have 3% of licensed teachers in the entire state of Minnesota are teachers of color. Only 3%, when 25-30% of our students are creative, our students of color, and growing, and they have the same issue. They go down and recruit from the South, they bring them here, and in about 2 or 3 years, they're flying away someplace because they can't take it.
Boy, well, we need more people of color everywhere. And as my dad would say, son, I want you to know that you're just as good as anybody else, and they're just as good as you. And it worked. This is Counter Stories. I'm David Cazares with the Counter Stories team. We'll be back.